This call is being recorded.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Endangered Accountability, a webinar on FOIA, government data, and transparency, hosted by the Digital Library Federation's Government Records, Transparency, and Accountability Working Group on the last day of Endangered Data Week 2017. I'm Catherine Kim, a DLF Program Associate, and I'll be moderating today's event. A quick shout out and thank you to Rachel Mattson, the Government Records, Transparency, and Accountability Working Group facilitator, as well as the members of the subcommittee that organized this webinar. Rachel couldn't make it today, but I know she really wanted to be here, and the working group has put in so much time and energy organizing this webinar. So to start off with some logistics, please take a moment to mute your microphone if you haven't done so already, to just drown out some of the background noise. We'll be sharing screens via Uber Conference to display the PowerPoint slides, but if you go to their wiki page, which is wiki.diglib.org/transparency, accountability, and I'll post that link on the chat box below. You can follow along on the agenda and the available slides. That's also where we'll be putting the recording of today's webinar. And if you're joining us via phone, that's where you can sort of get all of that information. We have a really great lineup of speakers today. I'll introduce them in order of their presentations. Alex Howard is the Deputy Director of the Sunlight Foundation. Alina Simo is the Director of the Office of Government Information Services, the Federal Freedom of Information Act Ombudsman's Office, which is a part of the National Archives and Records Administration. Joining Alina is Amy Bennett, who is a Management and Program Analyst with OGIS. And last but not least, Denise Ross is a Public Interest Technology Fellow at New America, specializing in data transparency and civic engagement with a focus on action at the local level. Each presentation will be about 20 minutes long, and we'll reserve the last 20 minutes or so at the very end of the webinar for questions for all four speakers. So welcome, everyone, and thanks for being here. Alex, could you start us off?
Good. Thank you so much for the kind introduction, and hello to everybody online. Terrific to connect with you here, as I've connected with some of you offline too. Today's an important day in Washington. Feels like every day is an opportunity to talk about how far we've come and how far yet I think we have to go, and the kind of progress that we've made together that we need to defend. And I've been prompted to talk about Sunlight's work and what we see, and I'll do just that. So we're named after Justice Louis Brandeis's famous quotation, Sunlight is the best disinfectant. We believe that transparency and accountability are very important to the nation. We've been working on that goal for over a decade now, combining lots of different techniques to open up information, to advocate for legislative reform, and to hold all three branches of government accountable at the state, local, international level, and of course here in DC. Our DNA is very much federal, and part of our work from 2006 onwards has been working on the Freedom of Information Act, from improving compliance with it to achieving reform of it, and we've seen lots of progress there. We celebrated its 50th anniversary with historic reforms after lots of people saw the issues since Congress did a glass pass at it. And now we've actually have an improved Freedom of Information Act. Yep.
Sorry to interrupt. Could you just exit the screen share and then go back to it? Some people can't access it right now.
Okay. So stop sharing.
Yeah, and then share it again.
And then share the screen. And then entire screen. All right. Preparing to broadcast again, folks.
Okay.
Sharing the screen.
So that pop-up came back. Up. Perfect. Thank you.
No problem. I love it. We can triage this on the fly. So we saw some really useful improvements to the FOIA go through last year. It wasn't everything that many people wanted, so there's still more work to be done. But we saw a presumption of openness pass into the U.S. Code. We saw more... I think involvement in the Office of Government Information Services, that's the Federal FOIA Ombudsman, we'll hear from later. We saw some useful involvement in reference to technology, where frequently requested records will go on to the internet, public inspection and digital format. And we've seen the Obama administration add additional reforms, including making a pilot where you have a release to one, release to all, release of records for given requester, be moved into being the policy that is promulgated throughout the entire nation. And now we're watching as the Department of Justice and the White House Office of Management and Budget work on rebuilding the nation's FOIA portal, that being FOIA.gov. And they just announced this week that they received $1.3 million to work with 18F, which is the software development shop inside of the, Uncle Sam, to help build it. So there's lots of good things that are happening there. We think this idea of open government data is really a key part of the nation's history, and it's a key idea to think through in terms of how public records are disclosed to the public, not just in response to a FOIA request, but in an ongoing fashion. And we think it's a big part of how the country was conceived, the philosophy it's built upon that really requires public servants and our institutions to be accountable to us and to give people the right to access information. And it's extending this idea that if we have something that is truly a public space, that public goods and resources should be available on it. And we think that the mandate to collect Census Bureau statistics actually puts open data into the DNA of our country in a way, because if that data, of course, is then used to make decisions about representation in Congress, and therefore it must be accessible and available to everyone as a common reference point to understand how our nation has changed and therefore how it should be represented in what number and where. And that kind of shared knowledge is an essential aspect of deliberative democracy and of liberal democracy and of the order that we've built in the United States and helped spread around the world. There's an expectation that something that's created with public dollars should be accessible to the public in a useful way. And that is something that's a riff on Lincoln, with knowledge itself should be available to the people about which it's created. And this is something we've seen our great institutions, our Navy, our presidents, or Congress all take up as an idea, and to make part of how we've shared knowledge and collected knowledge in the past, when we've done it through ships' logs, collecting information about the currents and the air as great clipper ships moved around the earth, to the creation of the great institutions, the agencies that oversaw and interacted with our agrarian economy, to the agencies that followed, that collected even more statistics, the scientific agencies. And of course, once we started putting satellites up into space and other kinds of sensors all around the earth, vast amounts more of data could be made accessible and available. And indeed, that has happened, as we, we've seen the wondrous images coming down from the Landsat satellites and, of course, from all the things that NASA puts up in the air. And it's really given humanity an extraordinary a window into what's happening, and to understand it and to anticipate it and to model it and to be more resilient in the face of change, whether it's climate change driven by the sun or the world's changes, or indeed by the activity of man. And of course, we can see that with eyes up in the sky and sensors on the air and the waters below. And the scientific agencies are matched by the regulatory agencies that also create huge amounts of data as they do their work and can disclose that to the public. And that in turn can have a positive impact upon the transparency of markets and on consumer protections and consumer safety, public health, and a host of other areas. Now, we've seen other kinds of data and other parts of the government disclose as well. Weather data is very important to the public, given how much we all depend upon forecasting. And we've seen satellite data become quite important, too. I'll talk about President Reagan being I think Tim O'Reilly gave me this line, the godfather or the grandfather of GPS, and then Clinton being its father. When he unscrambled the signals coming from those 12 satellites in geosynchronous orbit, let us all know where we are on the face of the Earth. And of course, when the iPhone and other devices started incorporating GPS, it dramatically changed how we are able to navigate the face of the Earth using these connected devices. And that's all about opening up data to the public. In 2009, President Obama took this further, signing the Memorandum on Open Government Transparency and Accountability in his first day in office, and then issuing an Open Government Directive in 2009, and then making it a priority, working with the nation's chief information officer at the time, Vivek Kundra, to set up an open data portal, effectively a catalog of all of our information assets that are on federal websites and to start federating out an understanding of what was out there. And to make that a priority, and they started with 47 data sets, now they have close to 200,000. An executive order built upon what was, came before, closing some of the gaps that I think needed to be in terms of the policy itself, why which agencies were still publishing their data in PDFs, and mandated that disclosure should happen in a machine-readable way, as what Sunlight describes as open government data, something that's structured. The difference between, say, a document and a spreadsheet, something that's free of licensing, it doesn't charge anything, that you can reuse, et cetera. And then to make it part of the systems that you buy so that as the federal government modernized all its legacy systems, open data would be part of how they were modernized. Now, we have been pushing for this stuff for the past decade. It's how we really, I think, have had an impact upon the nation's information policy, and we're proud of that. And we still believe that combining open data and open source software make governments more open, accountable, transparent, collaborative, and effective. And we see those ideas democratized in a real way all around the world at every level of government. And we've seen an expectation now come in that when we have an internet, that the government should have a website and it should be making information available to the public. And as long as it's doing that, it should do so in as effective and open and transparent way as possible, in keeping with the values of the society it serves. And we've seen the culture of government shifted as well by these efforts, as people need to bring data to meetings, to look at what the data says, to see if data needs to be created, to think about being stewards of data and how the data should be stored or accessed or distributed. And we've seen the demand for it continue to rise too, as more and more people come online, as they access services through their smartphones, as they use social media to communicate about what they're seeing. Open data is baked into our movements around the world and our understanding of it. And we're seeing this idea pass into dozens of cities and counties and states, and it has nothing to do with what's happening here in Washington at the White House or in Congress. We're seeing these policies be, I think, improved iteratively in concert and collaboration with people all around the world. We've helped to do that and continue to do that today. And we've seen the nation adopt an open source code policy, incorporating what we think about it and enabling agencies to collaborate differently across government. And we've seen librarians and accountants and technologists and journalists and researchers and academics and every other kind of informed and involved citizen step up all around the country and around the world to try to use the information that's available on the internet to try to get more of it out and to apply it to improve their communities and to reduce the information asynchronies between the powerless and the powerful. And we're seeing this baked into policies all around the world. We've been involved in making the ones in the cities. We've seen people working elsewhere. And the idea that people should have access to government data is now, I think, an expectation. We pushed for laws to mandate that if it's public, it should be online, but we're seeing many different parts of governments move towards that. We're still waiting for other kinds of policies, like the release to one, release to all policy that the Department of Justice said would be out. And today, we see threats today not simply as a matter of technical issues, proprietary formats, but political threats, defunding agencies, defunding their ability to collect data or to disclose data. We've seen this administration, unfortunately, set a very bad record on the kinds of issues we care about, from rolling back a corruption rule that was part of the Dodd-Frank law as part of one of the first actions in office, to making visitor logs secret again, to the enduring issue of the president himself not disclosing his own tax returns or the attacks upon the legitimacy of the press. These are all issues that concern us deeply, that implicate what Sunlight stands for and works on. We don't particularly want to have to make an assessment like this, but it is one that's driven by the evidence in front of the country. And the reason we all have to care about this is because transparency and accountability are part of our democratic system. And when you don't get access to public records by the public, by the journalists that dig into them to see what's actually happening as opposed to what people are saying, you see corruption come out of that. And if data comes off of the internet, if that collection is restricted, that also has an impact upon our ability to know what government is doing, how well it's doing it, And to use this data in our own lives, whether in an economic sense, in our social sense, or scientific sense, or any other. And that, in turn, reduces our ability to hold people in power that we elect to represent us accountable for what they're doing. So we're contributing by trying to report and document what we see. We're trying to alert the public and press to threats to these issues. And we're working in coalition with other good government and open government advocates here in Washington, D.C. to advocate for reform and defend progress in Congress and the agencies. We're pushing for Congress to pass the Open Government Data Act and bake in many of these expectations that were set over the last decade into the U.S. Code and make sure that data integrity and data disclosure and data transparency are things that we all view as important for every part of our society, no matter where you come from or what your belief is, that public access is for all of the public and it benefits the public. And we're looking forward to working with you and learning from you to make sure that that presumption of openness, that default openness that we all got into the Freedom of Information Act together, combines with the other reforms that we've all worked together to get through to make sure that this government is held to be the most transparent in history because of the efforts of the country's public, its press, and of course our courts and Congress. Looking forward to seeing what other people have to say about these issues. I know you're going to be enlightened by their presentations. Still there?
Terrific. Thank you so much, Alex. Could you... Oh, perfect. Next up is Amy and Alina from OGIS. Amy?
We're here. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alina. Can you hear us?
Sure can.
Amy is pulling up the PowerPoint presentation right now. So please stand by as we work out our technical difficulties. Display setting.
How was yesterday's event?
It went very well. We were sorry that you could not make it.
Me too. I was in New York City for another commitment, but I was eager to hear more about the new FOIA.gov and to hear what you all are up to.
Sure. Well, we'll cover some of that today, although it's a slightly different event that we were asked to cover. So I'm going to let Amy kick it off, and we'll introduce ourselves to everyone else, and then we'll talk
jump
about
right into it, because right. We have a lot of ground to cover today. So we want to start by thanking you all for inviting us to participate today. We really appreciate all the work that that you do to provide the public with access to government information, and we really look forward to hearing your questions. As we've said a couple of times, I am Amy Bennett, and I'm with the Office of Government Information Services. My introduction to FOIA came through the nonprofit Open Government Community. I was with OpenTheGovernment.org for several years, most recently as the assistant director. While I was in the non-government world, I worked extensively with the House and the Senate committees of jurisdiction on developing the FOIA, what became the basis of the FOIA Improvement Act. I've now, of course, joined government, and I am watching eagerly as agencies implement those reforms that were signed in June of last year.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alina Simo. I am the fairly new director of the Office of Government Information Services, OGIS. I became the director in December of 2016, so I've only been here for about 5 short months. I've got a lot to learn, but I certainly came in knowing a fair amount about the Freedom of Information Act. I was first exposed to it too many years ago when I was starting out my legal career as a law clerk at the Office of Information and Privacy, which is what it was called back then. Now it's Office of Information Policy at the Department of Justice. And I have continued to work on FOIA issues throughout my legal career, first at the Department of Justice as a litigator, frontline litigator, then later at the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the Office of General Counsel, where I stood up a FOIA litigation unit. The FBI got sued all the time, still does. And I've recently become part of the NARA family, the National Archives and Records Administration family. I came on board here in March of 2014 as the Director of Litigation, where we actually received a few FOIA litigations as well as other litigations that were brought against the National Archives, although we're very requester-friendly here, so we don't get sued a whole lot. But as Amy said, we're very happy to be here today. We understand from our colleague, Meg Phillips, who hopefully is listening in, that there was an expression of interest in hearing, in particular, more about the FOIA process. So we thought we would start off today by giving you some background on the history of the FOIA statute, its requirements, some hints about filing an effective FOIA request, giving you advice about where you can find help with the FOIA process. And we'll also spend a short time talking about our role, OGIS's role, in the FOIA process. So just to get started, it's a great picture of President Johnson, who is signing, probably against his will, the Freedom of Information Act statute in July of 1966.
This is actually not President Johnson signing FOIA because there was not a
Oh, that's right. There was no signing ceremony. That's
Sorry
right.
about that, Alina.
He did it at his ranch. The picture is not from the FOIA signing, thank you. There was no signing ceremony. He signed it at his ranch. And in fact, we know historically that there was a question as to whether the president would sign the statute, and his press secretary at the time drew up statements announcing both the signing and a veto of the bill. But since it was signed, the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, has remained a very robust statute and has been amended Well, normally we say approximately every 10 years. There have been some substantive and some procedural tweaks along the way. And without going into much more detail, we're happy to answer questions about that later if anyone's interested. But I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that my favorite quote is from the Supreme Court case of the National Labor Relations Board versus Robbins Tire and Rubber Company, which gave us the proposition that the basic purpose of the FOIA is to ensure an informed citizenry vital to the functioning of a democratic society, needed to check against corruption and to hold the governors accountable to the governed. In the next slide, we're going to just briefly cover the fact that there are lots of different rules about the FOIA, but we'll try to give you a quick summary. FOIA can be used by anyone regardless of citizenship. The requester is not required to show why they need the information or what they're going to use the information for, with a very few exceptions. Expedited processing and fee waiver requests are two of those. And the law provides the public with the right to ask for and receive government information unless it is covered by one of nine exemptions. Those exemptions allow the government to withhold information under those nine categories, including classified national security information, internal personnel policies or practices, covered by another statute, confidential business information, privileged information, including attorney-client, work process, deliberative process, personal privacy, law enforcement covered information, and my two favorite exemptions, 8 and 9, related to oversight of banks and related to wells. FOIA joke, very deep subject.
Oh, I get it. Wells, it's a deep subject.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. Law requires also certain information be posted on agency websites, including any record that has been requested three or more times. That is thanks to the FOIA Improvement Act of 2016. It sets time limits for agency responses to requests, 20 business days, not calendar days. And it provides for an agency to charge certain fees and requirements to provide fee waivers for certain categories of individuals, and Amy will cover that very shortly. And most importantly, the statute has an administrative appeal process, which is very important. It's a great opportunity for agencies to try to resolve internally a FOIA request that may not have been handled in the most appropriate fashion at the initial stage, and gives an agency a second bite at the apple before a lawsuit is brought in federal district court.
So before we move into what the law really means for requesters in practice, we want to give you just a couple of FOIA facts to really help set the stage. There are 115 federal agencies that are subject to the FOIA, and each of these agencies issues its own regulations that really explain how they process FOIA requests. And Alina reminded me earlier that it's important to note who is covered and who is not covered by FOIA. So the people who are covered are the executive branch agencies, some parts of the executive office of the president, and the independent regulatory agencies. Those bodies that are not subject to the FOIA are the offices of the president and the vice president and their staff, state and local governments, although most state and local governments have something similar to the federal FOIA, foreign governments, although they might also have their own law, municipal corporations, the courts. Congress did not apply this law to themselves, private citizens, or the presidential transition teams. So the number of requests that were received by the federal government has grown about 22% since 2011. During fiscal year 2016, federal agencies received more than 788,000 requests. There were rapidly approaching close to a million at this point, it feels like. About two-fifths of those requests, or about 40%, were sent to the Department of Homeland Security. In the same fiscal year, 2016, federal agencies reported a full-time FOIA staff of 4,263. This total includes people who spend only a portion of their time on FOIA-related tasks and contractors. The number of staff per agency ranges from zero at agencies that receive no requests and at 0.3 the agencies that only receive a handful to 529 people at the Department of Homeland Security who work on FOIA. And while you might have seen some headlines about massive fee estimates that are given by some federal agencies, we think it's useful to know that in FY 2016, federal agencies collected less than 1% of the total amount of reported FOIA costs. So to help you learn how to file an effective FOIA request, first we're going to walk you through the different pieces of a standard FOIA request, and then we'll outline what you can expect from the agency. FOIA specifies only two requirements to access a request. First, it must reasonably describe the records that are sought, and it must be made in accordance with the agency's published FOIA regulations.
So the first step to filing a request is determining which agency you should send your request to. We have the slide up to show you FOIA.gov, which is operated by the Department of Justice, and they have designed this website to be all sort of one-stop shopping of trying to navigate to the best of your ability where you might want to direct your request. There is an ongoing effort, we should also mention, I believe Alex also mentioned it, to build a centralized FOIA portal that is congressionally required now by the FOIA Improvement Act amendments of 2016. OMB and DOJ, Office of Management and Budget, and the Department of Justice have been tasked specifically with building a centralized FOIA portal that would allow requesters to just do one-stop shopping, file a request, and then it goes off and it goes right to the right agency. But in the meantime, we have FOIA.gov, and if you click on FOIA contacts on the top right-hand corner of the page, you can find more information about where to send your request. In terms of the details of a FOIA request, it must be in writing. Here on this slide, we have a typical FOIA request that hopefully met with some success. There are several free FOIA request templates or generators that can help fill in standard language, and both the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and the National Security Archive have good standard FOIA templates and letter generators to make your FOIA request. The most important thing you want to do is describe the records you are seeking with as much particularity as possible, so providing dates, times, events, places, and people involved. We have heard lots of stories, especially recently, about requests being administratively closed If the FOIA office cannot understand what you're looking for or if the request is overly broad, so you want to be as specific as possible. Some things to think about to help the FOIA office locate the records may include suggesting offices that might have responsive records if you've got some particular information based on research you've already conducted, suggesting keywords that can be used by the agency to conduct that search, and providing a time frame for the records that should be. That often is very helpful to agencies, knowing that they don't have to search, you know, a 50-year time period.
Right, and that's also really important, I think, as we've kind of moved into the digital world, or if you are making a request for email, a request for email can generate what used to be a pretty simple request into something that involves thousands of pages really quickly. So if you can provide a time frame, it really helps the FOIA office. Number one, narrow the number of pages that it needs to review, which helps you get the information faster.
Your request should also address fees, and Amy will be talking a little more in the next slide about fees, but whether you are willing to pay fees is something you should talk about, and as well as how much. If you believe you should be in a particular requester category for which fees are waived, you should explain how and why. And actually, I do want to stress how important that is to make sure you provide an ample explanation, not just say, I'm a reporter, therefore I should get free copies of everything. The agency is required to make an independent analysis of whether you fit into a fee category, so giving more detail is always preferred. So there are three basic fee categories. We're going to describe them in a little more detail, but the basic categories are commercial requesters, requesters in a favored fee category, which Amy will also talk about, and all other. And if you can fit in some of these categories, the fees can be waived if you can show the request is in the public interest because the information will contribute significantly to the public's understanding of the government's operations. And the decision regarding fee category and fee waiver are independent of each other. Some agencies will hold the decision on a fee waiver in abeyance until they know if the request even involves fees before making a decision. And that is because almost all agencies, hopefully, are doing this, are giving you the first 2 hours of search time free and the first 100 pages of duplication, assuming you're getting paper copies, free. So if your request only generates 50 pages, there may not be a reason for them to adjudicate either your fee category or whether you're entitled to a fee waiver. The agency's ability is now more significantly restricted and impacted by recent FOIA amendments. So if they miss the deadline of responding to your request, or if the request has more than 5,000 responsive pages, they may not collect fees.
So, No. Sorry about the technical difficulty there.
Please stand by.
Oh, no.
Is everything all right? We can switch back because I have the PowerPoint out.
Amy is trying to get it back up, and if you give us 1 second, we're going to get right back into the swing of things, we promise.
Sounds good.
We're on slide 11. Because we're very proud of this next slide that we're going to show you, this handy-dandy chart, FOIA fees at a glance.
All right. So sorry about that. Alina did promise I was going to tell you a little bit more about fee categories, and I am going to do that because this is one of my favorite topics. As you can see from this chart, commercial requesters are responsible for paying all search, review, and duplication fees. Requesters who are in the all other category pay for search fees beyond 2 hours and duplication fees beyond 100 pages. Requesters who are in the favored fee categories, which include news media, educational requesters, and non-commercial scientific requesters, are responsible only for duplication beyond 100 pages. Non-commercial requesters are entitled to, as Alina was saying, to 2 free hours of search and 100 pages. So that means if an agency doesn't already do this, you can always ask them to provide you only the with the records that they found during the first 2 hours of search and the first 100 pages without paying any fees. One other small wrinkle we want to add in about fees is that if you're interested in making a FOIA request for records that have already been transferred to the National Archives because they're of permanent historical value, there is a little bit different fee scheme, which is set by statute. The fees are generally a little bit higher, but Congress set them. So arguing with the National Archives, unfortunately, it's a no-go. But the reason I like this chart so much is because it shows why it's important to address your fee category in your initial response letter. We see a lot of requests for dispute resolution services regarding requests for fee waivers, but fees, unless you're dealing with a really voluminous or particularly hard request, fees are generally not an issue, especially if you are not a commercial requester. So if you can get your fee category right, you're probably not going to have to fight about fee waivers as much. So the other thing you really want to do is to provide good contact information for the agency, including an email address and phone number so that they can contact you if they want to discuss your request. So this will help you avoid a situation where if the agency doesn't understand your request, then they just administratively close it. If they can reach out to you, generally they will. It's also a good idea to tell the agency how you like to be contacted. So if you are a telephone-only person, if you don't ever check your email, like my mother, then you should tell them that. It's also a good idea to reach out to the agency and let them know if your contact information changes. So if you change jobs, but you still want the information for your new job, then you need to let them know to send it to your new address.
So for most requests, the first thing you're typically going to receive from the agency is an acknowledgement letter. If the request will take more than 10 days for the agency to respond, they should also provide you with a tracking number. Most agencies combine that in their acknowledgement letter. They will say, we've received your request, we've entered it into our system, and your tracking number is 56567, please refer to that number in any future correspondence. Also, as Amy pointed out, before its final response, the agency may also try to contact you to clarify or narrow your request in some way. If you are discussing narrowing a request with an agency and you need responsive records relatively quickly, you should definitely ask if you could qualify for the agency's Simple Track. So most agencies, I would say, nearly all agencies, have multiple queues of documents that they process. Usually it's based on the number of pages that are involved that are responsive to a request. And simple queues are usually, generally speaking, 500 pages or less for most agencies, 250 or less. So a relatively small size that they can get through very quickly. And those agencies can respond to more quickly. It's also helpful if you can work with the agency to triage and prioritize your request. So there may be portions of your request that can be put into a larger queue and that could be dealt with later, and a smaller queue can get to some of the things you're very interested in very early on. The agency may also tell you there are unusual circumstances that prohibit them from responding to you within the statutory time period, 20 days. Which could mean they have to go out to multiple offices to search if they have a decentralized search system, or the request involves a voluminous amount of material, or the agency needs to consult with other offices or other agencies. If an agency does have those unusual circumstances, the FOIA statute provides them 10 additional days to process your request, and hopefully agencies are communicating that fact with requesters. Most FOIA responses, particularly those that involve a substantial response, meaning a production of a certain amount of pages, are usually not processed, unfortunately, within the 20-day period.
Or the 30-day period.
Or the 30-day period for the unusual circumstances. And we recognize here at OGIS, delays are very frustrating to requesters. But unfortunately, kind of hard to avoid given the statistics that Amy pointed out earlier, given the number of FOIA requests that are being filed with the federal government every year and the fairly small proportional amount of FOIA requesters, FOIA processors that are actually working to address those requests. So it's frustrating, I think, all the way around, and agencies are doing their best to reduce backlogs and work within the constraints that they're given. But one other point we want to make is if you ask the agency for an estimated date of completion, which you have every right to do, the agency is required to provide you one. I know some agencies don't do that, but they're still supposed to. And even if they're not going to give you a number you want to hear, some agencies may say, yeah, we'll get back to you 3 years from now. They do have the ability to say that. Some agencies have become much more customer friendly and have online tools that allow a requester to log in and check on the progress of their request. If you are unhappy with the agency's response to your initial request, the statutory changes to FOIA from last year, 2016, now give requesters 90 days to file an administrative appeal. We think that's a great thing. Before the FOIA Improvement Act of 2016, there was a wide variety of appeal times. Some of them were as low as 20 days, Amy tells me. I know at the National Archives it was 35 days when I first arrived. 60 days seem to be the average, and that goes pretty quickly when you're a requester and you're doing a lot of research and you have a number of requests pending with different agencies. If the agency does not provide you with directions on how and where to submit your administrative appeal, we recommend you look at the agency's FOIA regulations or the agency's FOIA website or both. And also, this is a great place now where OGIS has become more involved. Even before you file an appeal, Congress has recommended through statutory changes that OGIS now be available for assistance, guidance, ombudsman-like services to direct requesters to the right place for either filing an appeal or trying to resolve a dispute with an agency. And you have a right to appeal any part of the agency's initial decision, which includes the adequacy of the agency search and any redactions they may have taken on any of the records that they do produce to you.
So now we want to just give you a couple of tips on where you can go for help as you're going through the FOIA process. So there are several general guides that you can use to help you better understand and move through the FOIA process. You can learn a great deal of basic information about the FOIA on FOIA.gov by clicking on the Learn tab. The Department of Justice also produces the guide to the FOIA, which is a much more in-depth, and it's a great source for case law. So if you're trying to appeal an agency's decision or learn more about exactly what courts say that an exemption is supposed to cover, that's a great source of information for you. The House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform also publishes a Citizen's Guide to FOIA. I think the latest version of the guide was published in 2012. And the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press has also launched FOIA Wiki, which is an open source resource for FOIA advocates to share information about FOIA topics. More specifically, the FOIA itself also requires that requesters are provided with assistance during the FOIA process. So requesters can receive ombuds and dispute resolution services during the FOIA process from agency FOIA requester service centers or their FOIA public liaisons. OGIS and service are also considered a non-exclusive alternative to litigation. However, opening a case with us does not prevent you from filing a case against the agency if we are unable to resolve the matter. We are a neutral party to the dispute, meaning that we do not side with the requester or the agency. We are asked to provide assistance with requesters, both by agencies, with requests both by agencies and requesters. And the other party to this dispute is always free to decline to participate in our services. Parties who enter into our dispute resolution process agree to keep the process confidential. I know that we are running over time, and I promise we will move through these last couple of slides really quickly. Now that you know a little bit about who the different parties are, we're going to tell you about the kinds of services that we can provide versus what an agency FOIA public liaison can provide. Since FOIA public liaisons are a part of an agency, they are in a much better position to help to describe the agency's records or suggest certain search strategies that they may use. They can also give you an estimated date of completion. If you're having a hard time communicating with the agency about any of those questions, though, OGIS can always help facilitate those discussions or act as a liaison. And as a non-exclusive alternative to litigation, we're really the people that are well-positioned to see if the parties can come to some sort of a mutually agreeable solution after the administrative appeals process. So we just want to really quickly mention that we've talked a little bit about our dispute resolution services, but we have two missions, and our other is to review compliance with the FOIA. We have a fairly robust agency assessment methodology at this point. And on the screen, you can see the programs that we have reviewed or are scheduled to review. After, as part of our review, we document the agency's practices and policies, and then we make recommendations for improving their performance. After an assessment is complete, we follow up with the agency after 120 days to see what they have done on our recommendations. At this point, so agencies have been given 60 days to report back to us. Agencies have addressed about 97% of the recommendations that we've made at this point. We also conduct assessments of possible government-wide compliance issues and have a self-assessment FOIA compliance program. So that's not all we do either. We also provide leadership and administrative support for the FOIA Advisory Committee, which brings together FOIA experts from inside and outside government to collaboratively develop recommendations to improve the administration of FOIA. We are halfway through the committee's second term at this point, and we are really excited about what recommendations they might be developing this year. We're also co-chairs of the Chief FOIA Officers Council and host an annual meeting, which was actually just yesterday, that is intended to allow the public to learn more about our reviews and reports and submit comments. And we also publish an annual report. As a FOIA ombudsman, we also believe in engagement, which is part of the reason we were so happy to do this conference call. And it's why we organize and host the National Archives Sunshine Week event, which is centered around James Madison's birthday. So it's usually about mid-March. Watch for next year's event. And we have an active blog and Twitter feed.
That's all of our contact information. So we're happy to answer questions at the end during the Q&A session.
Great, terrific. Thanks so much, Alina and Amy. Denise, are we going to be moving the slides for you?
Yes, please.
Okay, great. We'll do that in a sec.
I'll go ahead and get started. Hey, everybody. My name's Denise Ross, and I'm a public interest tech fellow at New America. And I recently left the administration where I was working with police departments to help them open data about police activities to help build trust with the community, improve the dialogue between the public and the police. But what I'm going to talk about today is in recent months, there's been talk about the potential that certain data sets may be vulnerable to maybe a slowdown or a pulling of resources, or might be become not easily accessible to the public. And there's a lot of ways that you can tank the publishing of an open data set. And it really does take like goodwill and strong leadership to keep data supply chains open and flowing. But what all this reminded me of is my work in New Orleans. I was in New Orleans in 2001 to publish data about from the census organized into neighborhoods, so it would be really easy for folks to use. And when Katrina happened, all of that sort of turned upside down. So I'd like to talk about the post-Katrina situation because it really is sort of a a story about what could happen if we lose access to the tremendous assets that we have in federal data sets. So, Amy and Alina, thank you so much for that incredible overview of the FOIA process. I was wishing I had had that after Katrina because it's just so amazing to have such a customer service-oriented focus in a federal government agency to help folks find data they need. So if we could go to the next slide. There we go. So I was working for a data intermediary. We were a nonprofit called the Greater New Orleans Community Data Center. And in 2000, that was the first time that the census was being released and also the internet existed. So there was this amazing potential to really democratize the data so that data would no longer be something that was just used by people in power to make decisions about communities behind closed doors. There was this promise that communities could take control of their own destinies by having access to information to advocate on their own behalf and to make informed decisions about how to use the limited resources available to them. So this was an example of a page on our website, how we organized the data into really easy to use formats for the public to use. Next slide. And then Katrina happened. And in the course of just, you know, a day or two, next slide, please, all of that census data that we had published became instantly historical. 80% of the city was flooded. So all of the federal statistics that have been collected about New Orleans now represented a historical status and not the current status. Next slide, please. And the residents of New Orleans scattered to the winds. This data set is actually a public data set, obviously, from FEMA. And at the time, we would have, the month after the storm, I saw in USA Today, basically a reporter had FOIA'd this data. It's the individual applicant data, and it shows of those people who were impacted by the storm and have documented damage on their property, where did they receive their FEMA check? What was the zip code where it was mailed to? And that was an indicator of where people had been displaced to. So, for example, I evacuated to my parents' house in Phoenix, so I'm a dot. I'm represented in one of the dots in Arizona in this data set. Now, it was another 5 years before I actually saw this data because we were not successful at our FOIA request to get the data from FEMA, but it would have been really helpful in the weeks and months following Katrina to be able to reach out to the diaspora and help them figure out more strategically what they needed to return home. Next slide, please. In November of 2005, the storm happened at the end of August, a researcher at Brookings commented that it had been easier gathering data for the rebuilding of Iraq than it was New Orleans. And we definitely felt that on the ground. But to the public in New Orleans, data became more important than ever. It used to be something we sort of took for granted that was there, and now we couldn't make really basic decisions about our lives and our businesses and our schools without data, and and federal statistics couldn't help us because they were all obsolete. So next slide, please. What the citizenry started doing is crowdsourcing their own data, and this is something that you can do to fill gaps when federal data sets might disappear or when you need more detail at the local level. So this was really great. People literally walked the streets, documented the condition of different properties. There are some downsides to this, though, and that is that neighborhoods that had more capacity had better data. And so in some cases, the disparities that existed between neighborhoods actually were exacerbated by this additional data disparity. And some local universities and nonprofits helped fill the gaps in some lower-income areas, like New Orleans East and the Lower Ninth Ward. But some areas around public housing developments, for example, had no data about them at all. The other thing that can happen, well, there's two other downsides to crowdsourcing. One is that the data can be biased because different methodologies might be used by different people in different neighborhoods. So it's hard to really get a view citywide or region-wide what's happening and completely be confident in the results. And I think more importantly, this was only a short-term stopgap measure. The people became fatigued from collecting the data themselves. They had rebuilding work to do, and they couldn't be out there walking the streets every day as well. Next slide, please. Now, the data that was being collected house by house, parcel by parcel, was based on this official local data set called the parcel layer. And for context, Alex talked about the Open Government Directive from 2009, and that really launched this whole world of open data that we, like federal statistics from the Census Bureau and Bureau of Labor Statistics and such, that we take for granted now. But back in 2005, there was no such thing as open data. And I also want to point out that this data set, the parcels with the addresses that comes from the local level, is what informs the master address file that's used by the U.S. Census to create the census data. So there is a lot of interplay between local and federal data sets. But the city would not release this data set. It wasn't part of the culture to open data, and the public records request process was not a well-oiled machine back in those days. So what happens when people can't get data, and maybe somebody gets a hold of that data set that has been that people have been requesting, next slide, please, is that bootleg copies of the data appear. The data goes underground. And that's all well and good, except for the fact that you lose a really important feedback loop. So that what happened with this parcel layer, the data about the rectangles of land that people own, is that different neighborhoods started improving on the data set. And so there were, dozens of forked versions of this data the feedback never made it back into local government to improve the quality of the data set. Next slide, please. And there was literally this guy in a specific city, a neighborhood in the city, working around housing issues. And he was the one, when people came to me asking me for the parcel layer, I would say, well, I don't have it, but I know a guy, and you can go to him, and he'll give you the parcel layer. The way this layer got out, actually, was that a contractor working for the local government had an intern who gave it to a friend who was doing neighborhood work, and from there it started to make its way around neighborhoods in the city. And what was really funny is that even federal agencies like EPA and FEMA came to us rather than the local government asking for this parcel layer, this bootleg data. And so I had to point them to the distributor of the data. And now, of course, the problem with this, there's lots of problems with this method of distributing data, but one of the more important ones is that it's sort of about who you know and how you can get the data, and it's not fair and free to everybody. Next slide, please. Another way that we filled the gap was with data philanthropy, and there's even more data these days that might be brought to bear to shed a light on what's happening in communities around the country. At the time, we were trying to figure out repopulation patterns at the neighborhood level, and of course, the census is only every 10 years, and so we were really behind the moon with regard to federal data. So we had to figure something out. And it turned out that company that delivers junk mail, most you probably recognize the missing children's postcards, they have the best list of households actively receiving mail. And they donated it to us. And if you could go to the next slide. And our role as an intermediary, we did a lot of work with the public. So we knew what the public needed. We knew what their misconceptions about the data might be. And so we made a very friendly interface for the public to access this data So what you see in these city blocks is the households actively receiving mail currently compared to the number of households receiving mail before the storm. And so this data philanthropy can be really, really helpful, but it also doesn't replace federal statistics, because the data quality tends to be better overall in areas of higher income with more economic activity. So, for example, Google Street View doesn't drive the streets in the lower income, not economically vibrant neighborhoods. It doesn't drive those streets as often as it does wealthy neighborhoods and economic corridors. And so lastly, I'd like to just talk about, you know, when you're building all of these, alternative data sources, it's one of the biggest challenges is the opportunity cost. So we started to fill in some gaps, and we heard, for example, that our map that used the junk mail data gave the lower Ninth Ward organizers enough intel that they could deploy their spring break volunteers gutting houses rather than collecting data. So that was really great. But federal statistics, we need them to do the heavy lift. It's something that the citizenry can't sort of mash together on its own. And so I'd like to end with just a few provocative sort of opportunities for this moment. And especially, libraries are certainly emerging as very strong partners in open government data at the local level. And I think one thing that we can all do, including Google and the new USA stats map that came out by the founder of Microsoft, I think all of us can encourage enthusiastic and prominent citation of federal data sources. Let's not take it for granted. The Starship Enterprise is not scanning the planet and then giving this information to Google so it comes up in your search engines. Like, these are formal federal programs that collect statistics, and they require resourcing and funding and healthy data supply chains in order to make it to the public to do that heavy lift that we need. So I think clear citation when you use federal data, or when you're talking about data that is, or a decision or a advocacy that is based on some federal statistic, let's give the feds credit for that. Secondly, building capacity of people and communities to use federal data. The more people can use data and talk about the impact it has on their lives, and it's real to them and it has real value to them, the more likely that data is to keep flowing. For example, I know that farmers in the Midwest use U.S. Forest Service data to figure out what kinds of trees they might plant that produce nuts that would withstand the changing climate and sort of future-proof their income streams. So that's a great use of federal data that is real to specific farmers in the Midwest. And then lastly, I think as a community, we should probably be thinking about a plan B for how to maintain access to data and novel sort of substitutions if data gaps appear for data that communities need in case federal data sources do dry up. And I'll leave it at that. But thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about this. It certainly it's something that's very close to home to me, having gone through Katrina and seen those dark days when we didn't have data to guide our way out of the disaster.
Thank you so much, Denise. So now we have about 25 minutes for Q&A, and when it's 5 minutes to 2:30, I'll just jump in for final questions. So we'll open up the space for the audience. So if you have a question, please unmute, introduce yourself, and ask away. Thank you. Sorry, I'll give you guys a few minutes to figure out. Is everyone's sound working?
I've got a question. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Hi, it's Cassie Findlay speaking. I'm with Kent State University at the moment in a teaching role. But I just had a question, and I'm not sure who would answer it, regarding the use of FOI application and response transparency platforms like What Do They Know in the UK, and the extent to which those kind of platforms have been taken up in the United States.
Hi, this is Alina Simo. Could we just ask the questioner to elaborate a little more on the question? I'm not sure we totally understand it.
Sure. Yeah. So there's a range of platforms that are used in some parts of the world. They come from non-government organizations, not-for-profits, civic hacking kind of organizations or transparency organizations. And they're platforms that enable the public to make their FOI applications to agencies publicly using the platform. It funnels through to the agency, and then the agency responses and any records provided are published there as well. So it's an alternative to doing it just a one-on-one interaction with the agency, and it means that other people perhaps interested in the same material have the benefit of seeing that process and the results.
So there are actually a couple existing portals like that in the United States, one of which is even built and maintained by the government. So that is, if you go to FOIA online, that is a place where you can make requests to any of the participating agencies. And they're up to 13. So there are 13 partners in FOIA online now, and you can use that portal both to submit your request, to correspond with the agency, and they have a repository where released records can be uploaded, and then the front-end users can search not just that repository, but the entire database, so you can find requests that were submitted on topics that you're interested in, any released records. And then the non-government solutions that are similar to that, MuckRock is a commercial enterprise. It's now a nonprofit, but I think that they do have different kinds of memberships so that you can pay to make certain requests, and then they take care of making sure that that request is submitted, following up with the agency, and then all of that information, the requester has the option of making that available for the general public. And is it iFOIA? Alex, do you know? Is it FOIA Machine or iFOIA that also has a similar makeup? It's one of the two, or maybe both.
Thanks.
So we just saw on the chat function that somebody has a question for us, for those that aren't on Uber Conference, that says, can you talk a little bit more about classified information? Is there any process for declassifying information, especially in historic documents? How does that work? Alina, I think, is going to talk a little bit about that. They're mandatory declassification requests.
Right. So I was actually just going to say that there are two ways to try to get access to records that are currently classified. One is certainly through the Freedom of Information Act. Even for permanent records, your requesters are free to do that. And the archives which is the permanent repository for all these records, does not have independent classification authority. So what they will have to do is take that request and go to the originating agency to ask that agency to re-examine the classified information and try to declassify it at that point. And that happens actually with a fair amount of frequency. We actually have at the National Archives and National Declassification Center, whose primary around-the-clock task is to do that very thing, is to engage with agencies all over the federal government to reach out to them and have them re-examine their classified information and encourage them to declassify it. And I don't have the statistics handy currently, but they've done some amazing work in terms of and Meg Phillips, thank you for putting up the National Declassification Center website. They've done some amazing work in terms of declassifying a lot of important classified records. The other area that Amy was referencing, I do not claim to be an expert in, so I'm going to say only what I know, which is there is a mandatory declassification process that is governed by the classified executive order, currently 13526. We'll see whether President Trump implements a new classified order. I've heard talk about the fact that one is in the works, so who knows what the new process is going to bring, but the current process allows for interested parties to come in and make a declassification request. Again, many of those I know I've seen handled from the National Archives perspective. If they're for permanent records, they, again, are handled by the National Declassification Center and go through a process. There are records that are subject to automatic 25-year reviews, there are records that are subject to 50-year reviews. And there's different categories of records that are laid out. So there are processes. I encourage everyone to go look at the agency regulations on mandatory declassification. Each agency is supposed to have regulations on that. And that's pretty much exhausting my area of knowledge. I have lots of other colleagues at the National Archives who are experts in this. They're just not here right now. But I hope that helps a little bit. And the chat is telling us thanks. That was very helpful. Oh, and Meg Phillips, our colleague, is suggesting we can invite folks from our National Declassification Center, who are much more knowledgeable about this area, to join in a subsequent call. I'm sure they would be happy to give a presentation on this area.
People can feel free to interrupt me if they have questions, but I had a general question for all three of you. So what opportunities do you all see for librarians and archivists in particular for promoting transparency? Denise, you were talking about Data Refuge earlier in Georgetown. If there are other things that you guys see that we can do.
So thanks so much for the question. This is Amy at OGIS. So, you know, we definitely view libraries as a critical component in ensuring that the public, that every member of the public has access to information. From our point of view, it would be fantastically helpful if libraries could help the public somehow better understand their rights to government records. So even if that's just having a flyer up that kind of has explains the FOIA process, or some sort of highlight some sort of a know your rights to government information tutorial on their public terminals. We think that would be really helpful. We do actually, since I mentioned an infographic that you could post up on FOIA, we created one recently that if you go to our blog, the FOIA Ombudsman, you can find. It's also available through the National Archives Educational Resource DocsTeach, which is something that teachers can use to create educational resources for their classes, so parts of lesson plans. I know I'm not supposed to use the words lesson plans, but it's a great little colorful, very basic description of what the FOIA process is and what you can expect if you submit a FOIA request.
And this is Denise. I was speaking on mute before. I'm sorry. I just posted the link to the data rescue events out of UPenn, and they have a great toolkit for hosting them at your own location. And what's great about these data rescue events is that they raise awareness about the valuable treasure that is federal data. And they're working with the Internet Archive to archive the pages. So even if the data remain, there's so much rich context on the web pages that helps us explain and use the data. And those changes are very easy to make as, just in the course of sort of changing the content and the angle of the messaging in an administration change. So I think there's tremendous value in what they're doing. And then, of course, obviously the next step is how do we get more people using the federal data that we have so it's less likely to be pulled down. Weather data, for example, is not at risk at all. More obscure data sets or data sets that might be politically inconvenient might be at greater risk for being pulled down or slow-walked or unresourced.
Can I ring in here too?
Yeah.
Great. Certainly to what he's just out, obviously the nation knows that the White House is not going to release its visitor logs online as open data as the Obama administration did. That's a great example of where a transparency measure can go backwards if there isn't a law behind it, like the Freedom of Information Act or its reformed versions that have come since and the regulations that come from it. And Sunlight has asked Congress to mandate disclosure of those logs, and we hope that people support their congressman supporting the bill like that. I think much as we do around tax returns. The federal issues aside, I think one really important role librarians can play is in connecting people to what's happening at their state and local governments too around these very same issues, because towns and states are, differently resourced than federal agencies, and certainly have varying degrees of technical capacity to make information available to the public online. But just about every one of them is trying. It has a town website, Facebook page, Twitter account, and an increasing number of cities have open data programs and policies of various maturation and robustness. And they have public records laws on the books. And I think that an important role for libraries in 2017 is helping people do what you've done certainly for me, helping people find information, from the stacks and from back in the day, the card catalog, now to also connect them to the digital services that many people come to libraries to use in terms of city services, and also city information and an introduction to all the different places that data is accessible or that applications and services that put it to work are accessible. And I think that librarians play a really important interstitial role in educating people about those local government resources and their rights to access information and make requests under the relevant local laws, and I hope that kind of civic education is part of what librarians do around openness. And we've seen certainly at Sunlight some really wonderful, productive convenings by local activist groups, Code for America brigades, wonderful data refuge events, which I've participated in with Denise and many other people from here in D.C. To come together to help access data, download data, organize it, and put it to work to better each other's situations. And I think that libraries are really a wonderful place for that, just as with schools, because
they're profoundly public places that are dedicated to accessing and organizing and studying and improving publicly shared knowledge. And you know, I hope that many more libraries are used as a base for that.
Terrific. Thank you, Alex. I think, there was a question that came up in the chat box from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Meg, would you like to field that one for the folks who are just joining by phone? And the question was, how does just making data publicly accessible, especially if not classified, compare cost efficiency-wise to supporting the FOIA staff and requiring people to make requests?
Would you like us to take a stab at that?
Please.
Okay. So one of the things that we see is certainly at the federal level, hundreds of millions of dollars to be spent on different records, and to a lesser degree, I think about $36 million last year defended against lawsuits. And the evidence is that at some agencies, public records laws are, and this is it's true at the state and local level too, used off by commercial entities, by businesses and corporations, hedge funds, others that are interested in business intelligence, particularly from the regulators, but also from others. And that proactively disclosing those kinds of frequently requested records, along with the records people are making requests for under FOIA for immigration records or for veterans to get access to their own data, could free up significant resources. I think the data I most recently saw, journalists are actually quite a small minority of the requester community, you know, in terms of their use of it. And, you know, members of the public are at a distinct, I would say, disadvantage compared to some of the corporate entities that make these requests. And I think that if we speaking directly to the question, the more that you publicly disclose online and open usable, useful format, frequently requested data sets with high periodicity, the more you shift demand to those where there is a serious wrangling, often mediated through the judicial system, around data related to deliberations or the use of power, where there's more of a gray area. And I think that the more information that is proactively disclosed that can be under the exemptions of the FOIA directly to the public, the more that it doesn't have to suck up staff time and, you know, taxpayer dollars to be dealing with a request, because the information is already out there. And in many cases, governments can anticipate the kinds of data that people want. The local level here in D.C., as they're considering whether to apply the local freedom of information law to the most local unit of government in the neighborhoods, which is a burden to them because they don't have budget for IT to make the most popularly, the most popular items available, that being things like their correspondence and email, their calendars, the budget, and any meeting agenda or minutes. And if those are all put online with that investment, then the city doesn't end up having to spend staff time and money to make them proactively available in response to an individual requester. And certainly that kind of approach to being open about governance is one that we think is wise generally.
And this is Denise. If I could add on to that, at the local level, police departments they often start in their transparency efforts with the most commonly requested data sets through their FOIA or public records request. And Lincoln, Nebraska actually just joined the Police Data Initiative and has committed to opening data about their activities. So you might see if there's a way to collaborate with them around that. So there's some jurisdictions are saying that there's a cost savings, especially with like 911 calls and that type of stuff that are frequently asked for. Other jurisdictions just say that the nature of the public request changes and becomes more specific and sophisticated. So I've heard it go both ways, but the one thing that I have heard is that it improves the quality of the communication between the government and the people by having a shared base of information to start with.
So This is Amy over at OGIS, and I'll say that at the federal level, we've heard much the same, that, you know, that the jury is still out on whether or not putting up more information, what effect that has on the total number of requests that come in. The U.S. government has put up more and more every year, and yet the number of requests continues to increase. So I think the jury is still out on that. And there definitely are two schools of thought, I think, on particularly with FOIA. So there is the emphasis on putting up frequently requested records. So this is where, you know, you kind of get to the once something has been released or you think it might be requested at least three times, then it should go on the website, versus the approach of release to one is release to all. There are some agencies that are, even though it's not a finalized policy yet, they are posting everything that they release. I think that the utility of posting everything that is released is probably going to depend a lot on how it's posted. So if it's got rich metadata, if it's been OCR'd, so it's keyword searchable, that's good. If it's somehow connected to the request that generated its release so that you have a little bit of context for why these records are important, that's even better. But it'll be interesting to see what happens at the agencies that are posting everything, what happens to the number of requests they receive each year, and to see what kind of hits they, if, you know, hopefully they are all monitoring their web analytics and can understand, are people actually using this material? I think it'll just be interesting to see what happens at the federal level in the next couple of years, given that there are a couple of different kind of experiments going on with putting data online or information online.
I think we have time for maybe one quick question, if anyone wants to throw out any last words. Oh, Sheila had another question. Does FOIA not apply to Congress or courts?
That is correct. It's great how Congress wrote themselves specifically out of being subject to FOIA. So you're not able to access congressional documents or court documents until they have been accessioned to the National Archives. So permanent records and that are in the collection of the National Archives from the courts and from Congress are accessible, but today's records that are not of permanent historical value that are being created are not accessible to FOIA. And of course, and then the courts, you can pay for access through PACER, but they don't have anything similar to FOIA. How long? Do you know how long it is until the records come, Sonora?
So Meg is probably even more savvy about this, but I know that there's a minimum of 15 years before records are deemed to be of permanent historical value and can start being transferred. It's typically 30 years.
And they're just
the average that we use.
They're mostly select members or members that elect to send their records there and committee records. Is that correct?
Yes. That's been my understanding.
Meg, you can correct us if we're wrong.
I think I finally got myself off mute. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can look up the details, but that sounds correct. NARA never actually owns congressional records. They never relinquish total control of them, and I think it's pretty long for Congress. However, we do get the records of committees on a fairly regular basis.
So we're reaching 2:30, so I think we can close here. Thank you, Alex, Alina, Amy, and Denise for sharing your expertise. I think this was so useful. And thank you, everyone in the audience, for attending. In a few hours, if you go to endangereddataweek.org, we'll have the recording of this webinar up. So I hope everyone has a good day.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.